rich, and now you're the one who hides, and they're over there counting up to 10. You go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, because they've just learned all these numbers, and all these numbers are so exciting, and they can't stop themselves at number 10. This is exactly what a brain without a whole lot of frontal function looks like. There's another realm in which you can get brains without a whole lot of frontal function, brains that have been damaged. A remarkable finding, which is a substantial percentage of people on death row in this country have a history of major concussive head trauma to the front of the brain. And this will come back to haunt us in a few minutes, the implications of that. The other version of a frontal cortex that's not working very well is when you get a wildly violent criminal act by someone who is young enough that their frontal cortex is not developed all that much yet. And the possibility of this is what motivated a Supreme Court decision a number of years ago saying that you cannot execute somebody for a crime they did under age 18. And the decision explicitly talked about how some parts of the brain were not fully developed at that point, that there was some degree of impairment of frontal regulation of behavior. Now, as I mentioned, humans have the biggest, most dramatic frontal cortices out there, recently evolved. You know, other species have frontal cortexes too. Rodents have them. Primates have them. They don't have a whole lot. Take, for example, monkeys like baboons. And baboons are schemy, competitive, backstabbing animals, but they're not very strategic about it because at all sorts of critical points, they blow it because they're wildly impulsive animals. For example, baboons can form cooperative coalitions, two males who help each other out in a fight. And what you wind up seeing is this should be a brilliant strategy because four hands are better than two, or two tails are better than one, or whatever. And a stable cooperative coalition should be unstoppable. But with an astonishing frequency, the fight finally breaks out, and the guy spins around and attacks his coalitional partner. Because how could he resist? Because he's only got like 7.5 frontal neurons. And I remember some years ago sitting at a primatology conference looking at a film about primates that have really good frontal function, apes like chimps and such, and we were watching a film that was called Chimpanzee Politics, looking at chimpanzee political power-grabbing strategizing, which they're really good at, and I was sitting next to another baboonologist, and at some point, we turned to each other after some amazing chess move that one of these chimps had just pulled off, we turned to each other and said, "My God, that's what a baboon would love to be like if it had a shred of self-discipline or gratification postponement." And they don't, because they don't have much in the way of a frontal cortex. Transition to apes, chimps, for example, and they've got a lot more frontal cortex, a lot better regulation of impulsivity, but they're still not in the range of a human. And you can show this with a study. It looks something like as follows. Here you have, in this hand, you've got one M&M. In this hand, you have five M&Ms. The chimp has a choice as to which hand to reach for. The rule is, if it reaches for the one M&M, you quickly pull your hand away, and the chimp gets a reward of five M&Ms. If the chimp reaches for the five M&Ms, you quickly pull your hand away, and the chimp gets a reward of one. In other words, if the chimp is disciplined and ignores the five M&Ms right there and instead is going for the tougher decision, going for the one M&M, it gets the much bigger reward. Chimps cannot do that. They are ready to reach for the one M&M to do the more disciplined thing, and they just can't stop themselves. They reach over for the five because the chocolate is right there in their face and it smells so good, and they don't have enough frontal neurons to make them do the right strategic thing. Go for the one M&M because you get the bigger reward. But now you make a very important elaboration in the experiment. Now this hand has one little chip of wood. This hand has five chips of wood. Reach for the five chips, pull the hand away, and the chimp gets one M&M. Reach for the one chip, pull the hand away, and the chimp gets five M&Ms. The same sort of deal. If you are more disciplined and reach for the one piece of wood, you get a bigger reward. And now chimps can do this before the stimulus, because the stimulus is less salient, it's less in their face. The chocolate, I can't stop myself. Wood chips, the chimp has enough frontal function to go for the single piece of wood and thus get the bigger reward. Now, as alluded to when talking about people in sort of who have come into the criminal justice system with a history of concussive head trauma in the front, history of frontal damage, there is a whole challenging world out there of what happens when people get frontal damage. And in terms of organic impairment, a problem with the brain that the courts generally recognize, there is the gold standard out there, which is when somebody is so organically impaired, so neuropsychiatrically troubled that, as the standard goes, they can't tell the difference between right or wrong. Trivia fans, this is something called the McNaughton rule in criminality, and it often goes with people with severe schizophrenia where they can't tell the difference between right and wrong. Get somebody with frontal damage and they can tell the difference between right and wrong, they simply can't regulate their behavior. They don't have volitional control. And these are often people, in fact, who can verbalize what the appropriate rules are, can verbalize what the strategy should be, could verbalize saying, I know I should reach for the one M&M because I get a bigger reward that way, and then they go for the five because they can't control their behavior. And this is a huge challenge in the criminal justice system. This is not McNaughton, you can't tell the difference between right and wrong. This is, you can tell the difference, but because of an organic impairment, you can't regulate your behavior. And in my view, there's way too few states out there that recognize this is as much of an impairment as the right and wrong dichotomy. Okay, so now we've got a pretty good sense about how the frontal cortex works, how it evolved, how it develops during growth, during childhood, what happens when it's damaged. So what does stress do to frontal function? What does stress do to the frontal cortex? And what you wind up seeing is lots. And once again, the usual suspect, it's mediated by glucocorticoids. Back to our endless theme here, hormones, brain, chemical messengers, etc., they work by way of binding to their specialized receptor. Thus, glucocorticoids work by way of glucocorticoid receptors. You look in the brain, and there's two areas that have glucocorticoid receptors at far higher levels than elsewhere in rodents and non-human primates and humans. What are the two areas? You guessed it from last lecture, the hippocampus. And from this lecture, the frontal cortex. These are the two hot spots in the brain when there are sufficient amounts of stress and glucocorticoid excess that you're beginning to mess with how the brain works. It's the hippocampus and frontal cortex that go first. Now, the last lecture, dribbling over into this one, really looked in great detail as to what happens in the hippocampus. With chronic stress, chronic glucocorticoids, that's that whole picture of atrophy, potential recovery, dead neurons, no more neurogenesis, that kind of thing. What's going on in the frontal cortex with chronic stress and glucocorticoid excess? Far less studied, a very new literature that's just emerging, but what you tend to see is atrophy of neurons in the frontal cortex. Atrophy in terms of processes retracting, same deal as in the hippocampus. The frontal cortex, again, the surface of the brain, and it comes with a number of layers, tends to thin out. You've got less complex connectiveness there, which thus is not surprising if you're having neurons disconnecting. Very similar picture to in the hippocampus. What's an extremely challenging finding at this point is what happens after the stress is over with. What we heard in the hippocampus relevant to Cushing's disease is after you've got the atrophy of the hippocampal neurons, they can regrow, they can reform their connections, and things go back to normal. What's known at this point, very, very recent studies showing in the frontal cortex, yes, stress, glucocorticoids, you get atrophy of these neurons, and after it's over with, yes, they grow back, but they grow back with different sorts of connections. What does that mean? Nobody knows at this point. All that's known is lots of stress, lots of glucocorticoids, and the frontal cortex thins out, atrophies, almost certainly isn't working as well. And in the aftermath of it, it's going to work differently than it did before, without anybody having a good sense yet of what differently means. Now, many lectures, oh so many ago, we were looking at the consequences of sustained stress during child development, everything about growth, prenatal stress, etc. Back to that point about the frontal cortex being the last part of the brain to mature, what happens with stress during childhood? What does that do to the frontal cortex? And there is such a disturbing, such a depressing literature emerging out there having to do with childhood development of the frontal cortex and socioeconomic status, your degree of poverty, education, the wealth of the neighborhood you live in, that sort of thing, socioeconomic status. And the literature has been emerging for some years, suggesting by some appallingly young stage, by like kindergarten, there are already differences in socioeconomic status in terms of how well kids have their frontal cortex working, how well they do emotional regulation, gratification, postponement. And the first studies are coming out now showing that those correlate with differences in metabolic rates in the frontal cortex. Mind you, the usual caveats, this is a statistical phenomenon. This is on the average what you see. There's huge amounts of variability. Nonetheless, a totally disturbing suggestion that by an extremely young age, your socioeconomic status, the sheer, utter, damn blind luck you've had in terms of which household you got yourself born into, is already having an impact on your developing brain, how readily you control your impulses, how readily you control your behavior. This is a theme that will come back in a whole lecture later on, having to do with stress, health, and socioeconomic status. Now, lurking in here is a very important subtle point, which is there's huge excitement these days about what genes have to do with behavior, that sort of thing, sequencing the human genome. Keep this in mind, interesting implication. If the frontal cortex is the last part of the brain to fully mature, by definition, the frontal cortex is the part of the brain least constrained by genes and most shaped by environment. So what we've seen here now are all sorts of circumstances with chronic stress, chronic glucocorticoids, where the frontal cortex doesn't work as well. What is it that we've explained here? This oh too familiar circumstance where during a period of stress, you make some decision that is just asinine, which at the time seems utterly brilliant and insightful, and you spend an awful long time afterward dealing with the adverse consequences. You really do need to have a nice functional frontal cortex, and chronic stress doesn't do good things to it.
Lecture 15. Stress, sleep, and lack of sleep.
All things considered, there's hopefully a lot of useful advice that's been coming out of this course so far. Things you might want to do more of in your life, things you might want to do less of. And I've even taken some of these points to heart. Never once have I taken a bubble bath, just spiked with glucocorticoids. In college, I wouldn't go out with my buddies and chug down sort of mixtures of prolactin and glucagon. You know, there's a lot of useful stuff that could come out of paying attention to these things. However, this is a lecture where I just have to put all sorts of fine print up front. This lecture, I am an utter hypocrite, because what this lecture is about is how you need to get enough sleep. I personally don't get enough sleep. In fact, there's a guy, a researcher at my university, a man named William Dement, who's like the dean of sleep research. And basically, I live in terror of running into this guy when I'm really looking moth-eaten in the morning, because the whole theme here is you really do need a lot of sleep. because it is highly intertwined with how your body deals with stress. So this is one of those lectures that I plan to pay no attention to as I'm giving it, and thus we've got the main theme of this lecture. This is one of those do as I say, not as I do. So we start off thinking about sleep. And the very first thing to deal with in terms of sleep is it's a totally weird thing to have happen to your body and your brain. And there's all sorts of diseases of abnormal amounts of sleep, as we're going to see in a few lectures. When you have severe clinical depression, your sleep pattern changes in all sorts of ways. There's this disease narcolepsy, where you can fall asleep suddenly, no warning, and often in response to emotional arousal. How's this for a weird disease? There's this disease called Odin's curse, which is due to a certain type of tumor in your brainstem. And what you've got there is, you know, your brainstem isn't working very well, and what you have is a deep problem. Now, apparently, Odin was some nymph or something that Zeus was hitting on, and she was not willing to go along with this. So he placed Odin's curse on her, and what he did was take away her ability to breathe automatically, where she had to breathe consciously. And I'm not quite sure how much the legend got into the physiology of this, but nonetheless, Odin's curse is when, thanks to this tumor, you cannot breathe involuntarily, you have to think about it. And what does this disease kill you from? From lack of sleep, because you go to sleep and 30 seconds later you wake up gasping because you need to be awake to remind yourself to breathe now and then. Totally creepy stuff. But that doesn't even begin to scratch the surface. When you really think about sleep and you twitch and your eyelids do things and you sleepwalk at times, which is totally creepy, and, you know, you drool and you get penile and clitoral erections, and that doesn't even deal with species that have very odd things going on with sleep. For example, there are species out there that sleep with one half of their brain at a time. And often what that's about is some species that better be on the lookout for predators 24/7. One half of your brain sleeps. There's bird species that are able to sleep while they're flying. There's fish that sleep. The whole notion of fish sleeping is just weird enough. There's even fruit flies that sleep. And not only is their sleep this weird, suspended state, it's very structured. There's all these different sleep stages, slow wave sleep, deep, rapid eye movement sleep. It's just a very weird thing to have going on in you. Nonetheless, it does. And what we have to start off with right off the bat is what's going on in your brain when you are sleeping. And it turns out it's got to do with which of those sleep stages you were in, whether it's your slow wave sleep, whether it's this rapid eye movement stuff. Okay, typically when you are sliding into a good night's sleep, the first thing that kicks in is this slow wave sleep. It's termed that from when they stick electrodes on your head and monitor your electrical physiological activity up there. And this is a pattern where you've got very slow cycles of activation. And not surprisingly, when you stick somebody into one of those brain scanners at the same time, which we've already heard about, one of the ones that tells you which part of the brain is metabolically active, what you see is, with the onset of slow-wave sleep, everything is less active. Of course, this makes sense because you've slipped into deep sleep there. Most of your brain has much less activity going on. That makes perfect sense, and we'll see exactly why that makes wonderful sense given a lot of what sleep is about, restoration of energy in your nervous system. But then along comes REM sleep, which is really quite different. REM sleep, and suddenly some parts of your brain become completely silent, and other parts become even more active than usual. Okay, which parts become completely silent? Most of the areas, except one particular part of your brain, as we'll see, is an exception. But which areas become more active than usual? And one very interesting one is known as secondary sensory cortex. What's that about? You look at something, and the information gets into what's termed your primary visual cortex, and it gets processed there, and you extract some information about what's going on, and then you kick that up to your secondary visual cortex and tertiary, and it's doing all sorts of processing. Meanwhile, you've got your primary auditory cortex, that sort of thing. So when you're looking at things that are vivid, when you're hearing a lot of sounds, you get activation of those brain areas, primary, secondary, and tertiary cortex. Something different happens during REM sleep, which is the primary sensory cortex goes silent. And the secondary and tertiary activate like crazy. In other words, those parts of the brains are processing things as if you were having visual information and auditory information without the primary layers activating, without any actual visual auditory information coming in. What's this about? This is dreaming. This is dreaming, active processing of sensory information that simply is not there. This is instead of activation of these layers from your eyes, your ears, it's from whatever parts of your brain are running the, dreaming process. So that's one striking thing. Meanwhile, another area of your brain becomes more active than usual, and this is one we remember from oh so many lectures ago, and this is the limbic system. Limbic system, because suddenly you've got all sorts of emotions ripping around your head. There's not a whole lot of us who have dreams about, contrapuntal music or calculus. Instead, we have dreams that are just frothy with emotional content, unless you're the sort of person for whom calculus is frothingly emotional. But for the most part, this winds up being a realm of limbic activation, highly emotive content to dreams. Now, where's the limbic system getting off becoming more active than usual during dream stage? When you think of this as everything in your brain should be going offline, but you've got these secondary, tertiary parts of your sensory system hallucinating away with information that isn't there, dreaming, and you've got the limbic system all activated, the emotional content of dreaming. One additional area, very interestingly, shows not just that pattern of slow wave sleep becoming less active than usual, this one area just hits the basement, turns off entirely. Which area is that? And this is straight out of the previous lecture. What area is this? Prefrontal cortex. What does the prefrontal cortex spend a whole lot of time doing? As we heard previously, it makes you do the harder thing when the easier thing is tempting, when the harder thing is the right thing to do. A lot of what your prefrontal cortex does when it's pulling that off is it's inhibiting the limbic system, saying, oh, no, no, don't actually try to butt heads with that moose because that's a particularly scary one. A lot of what the frontal cortex does is rein in limbic function. And thus, what you suddenly have during REM sleep when you were dreaming, the frontal cortex goes silent. That's why your limbic system runs amok. That's why in dreams you do all sorts of imprudent things in all sorts of junctures where you don't do the harder right thing and instead you do with greatly interesting consequences the easier thing. You've got this pattern, frontal cortex goes down. So we've got this odd picture, perfect sense during slow wave sleep, the brain is using much less energy. During dream stage, REM sleep, this very interesting pattern, more of a decrease in energy consumption through most of the brain, but cortical activation processing imaginary sensory information, the limbic system supplying the weirdo emotive content to it, and your frontal cortex going into a deep, deep sleep where it's got nothing to say, that's inhibitory in nature to your limbic system. Okay, so this is a profile in terms of the energetics, what's happening there. And of course, when you begin to think about this, up comes the inevitable question of why is it that we dream anyway? Why is it that we have any of these sleep stages? Most broadly, as the initial question, why do we sleep? Why do we need to sleep at all? And the answer is somewhat obvious in that sleep restores energy. What sleep onset is usually about is fatigue. All of that makes perfect sense. You get tired and thus you go to sleep. You get exhausted by increased activity and you go to sleep earlier and are more in need of it. It's about restoration of energy. What's become clear is what is particularly focused on with energy restoration is in your brain. And that has to do with one of the great factoids you are not allowed to teach introductory neuro anything or other without pulling this one out in terms of impressing everybody with what a tough sort of impressive organ the brain is compared to those dumb old kidneys or liver or something. The brain constitutes about 3% of your body weight, and it uses 20-25% of the energy. The brain is incredibly expensive, and that gives you some insight into why your, you know, epididymis, if you happen to have one of those, why it's not the one solving problems for you, why the brain does this fancy stuff. It consumes enormous amounts of energy. So you need to replace those enormous amounts. Just to make things even messier, there's all sorts of cells that store a lot of energy. Back so many lectures ago, storing energy in your fat cells, your liver, your muscle. It turns out brain cells, neurons, are terrible at storing energy. They have virtually no capacity to do it. You get an energy crisis, like a stroke, and your neurons have about 30 seconds worth of energy available to them before they crash. There's another cell type in the brain called glial cells, and they're a bit better at storing energy, but nonetheless, your brain uses a ton of it, doesn't store it very well, so a lot of what sleep is about is restoring energy throughout the body, and especially in your brain. So that's one of the things it's useful for, and that's the traditional explanation for what sleep's about. It's only in recent years that people have figured out there's an additional thing that's really, really interesting, which is you consolidate memories during your sleep. And we all know this phenomenon, which is you study something right before you go to sleep, you practice a piece of music, whatever, and the next morning it's magically in there to a much greater extent than if you had done that same learning in the morning and tested it towards late afternoon. There's consolidation of memory that goes on in the brain during that time. And there's at least one hint as to how that might work. When you have onset of sleep, what decreases in your bloodstream? Glucocorticoid levels. And we know oh so well by now that high levels of glucocorticoids can disrupt aspects of cognition. Sleep is the perfect time to get rid of those glucocorticoids and do a whole lot of memory consolidation. So what does this look like? This pattern of, oh, you learn a bunch of factoids and it's being consolidated during your sleep, those factoids instead of something else. Some wonderful work by a scientist named Bruce McNaughton has shown that in the brains, in this case in rats, if you show certain patterns of activation in a rat when it's learning some new task, some maze or whatever, right before it goes to sleep, study the brain while the animal is sleeping and it preferentially activates the same pathway. It's running it again and again, getting that information in there. Now, one of the other things you do during sleep is you sleep on it. You do all sorts of things with judgment. And lots of the time, we do indeed sleep on it. We come up with some assessment, some insight, some gut feeling, some intuition. Now, in that regard, you don't make a judgment about whether or not the final digit of some phone number was 6 or 7 kind of thing. You're making judgment about complex sort of circumstances. But that comes into it also. So at some point, we then have to deal with the even bigger, more mysterious issue, which is, why do we dream? If sleep is about energy restoration, what's the deal with dreaming? And, you know, there's been a gazillion theories over the years. The purpose of dreaming is to work out sort of the troubled, ambivalent aspects of your relationship with your mother, or you dream in order to keep surrealists and sort of on the dole and working away there. Or, you know, then there's that whole world where you have one of those totally bizarre sex dreams with somebody you never even thought about before, and the next day you act all weird about them around the water cooler. But what's in a lot of ways one of the more convincing explanations as to what dreaming is about is it's a chance to use circuits in your brain that you may have underused during the day. And this is usually summed up in the notion of a use-it-or-lose-it kind of model. And if you think about it, this is both perfectly reasonable and utterly contradictory with something I talked about earlier. Okay, so you think about this here, and you need to use a circuit that's underutilized. Suppose, for example, you are thinking far too infrequently about William Seward, Secretary of State in the Lincoln First Administration, and your brain really needs more of this because you are not utilizing that William Seward neuron. You know from so many lectures ago that's a gross simplification. There is not a William Seward neuron. There's instead a William Seward network, and it's the intersection, you know, the network of secretaries of states and the network of, like, stud muffins from the 19th century, and out pops William Seward's name. So you're not thinking about that enough during waking hours. So a notion of what dreams are about is exercising pathways that don't get enough stimulation during the day. So why is that contradictory? Why that's contradictory to something we just heard about? The argument from the work of someone like McNaughton is the very pathways, the very patterns you activate during the day as you learn something, those are the patterns you run again and again at night to consolidate some sort of new information, with this argument that what dreaming is about is activating pathways that otherwise atrophy away. The very pathways that are least active during the day are the ones that get activated at night. It's not quite clear what the resolution to that one is, but nonetheless, what you've got are some very intriguing array of possibilities for what dreaming is about. What is clear, though, is not only insofar as sleep in general is a good point for consolidating memory, REM sleep appears to be a particularly good one. Preferentially disrupt that and you screw up cognition, part of this larger theme of disrupt sleep as a whole and you get cognitive problems. You don't remember stuff as well. You don't learn things as well, with one very interesting exception. And this was work done by, in fact, an ex-graduate student of mine, Alana Hairston. And what she did was show that there's one domain in which sleep deprivation improves your memory. And it works as follows. It involves something called a reversal task, which is a fiendishly challenging thing for your brain. Suppose you learn some process that you need to do. If you're a rat, for example, it may not be particularly fancy, which is whenever this little light comes on, you've got to hit this lever. If you do it correctly, you get a food pellet as a reward. So you spend all day learning this to the point that every time that light comes on, you are lunging for that lever. You have learned this association. You have learned this task. Now, they hit you with a reversal task, which is all of a sudden, instead of light comes on, hit the lever, you get a food reward. Now, suddenly, without warning, the deal is light comes on, and it's if you don't hit the lever that you get a food reward. You have to completely reverse what it is you've learned. And that's a hard thing to do, except if you were vastly sleep deprived, because it becomes much easier to do a reversal test. How come? Because in the first place, you didn't learn this association very well. You didn't consolidate this rule that when the light comes on, hit the lever. So the next morning, you're not sitting there saying, light comes on, hit the, remember, hit the, okay, it's different now, don't hit it, okay, this is very, because you haven't learned the first thing very effectively at all. You haven't consolidated it, and thus, individuals, animals, humans, who are sleep deprived are better at reversal tasks the next day. Nonetheless, this is within a larger framework of sleep is a good thing for memory consolidation. Dreaming has all sorts of advantages there. Yes, you want to get enough sleep and the right distribution of subtypes of sleep. And again, as a warning, we will get to depression, where one of the things that goes dramatically wrong is not only trouble sleeping, but with a very particular pattern and a complete disorganization of the structure of sleep. So now, with the various pieces in place, what is sleep about metabolically in your brain? What purpose might sleeping serve? What purpose might dreaming do? What we now need to do is, of course, superimpose stress on top of this. What's going on with sleep deprivation? Very simply, it's a stressor. If you don't get enough sleep, your levels of glucocorticoids go up in your bloodstream. And in fact, there's a very interesting explanation for this. Back to the lecture, the basic organization of endocrine systems, the hypothalamus releases a hormone which stimulates the pituitary to release its hormone. Remember, luteinizing hormone, releasing factor, luteinizing hormone, on it goes. What I failed to mention, just as one of those miserable elaborations, some of those brain hormones are releasing hormones. They stimulate the pituitary to release its particular hormone. Some of those brain hormones are inhibitory hormones, ones that decrease pituitary activation. Now, what everybody discovered early on was a releasing hormone coming from the brain, which activates the pituitary to release its hormone, and down at the adrenal, you start secreting glucocorticoids. Just to give you the horrible terminology, CRH, corticotropin-releasing hormone, that's the hypothalamic hormone, the brain hormone, that stimulates glucocorticoid secretion. And what's always been lurking in the background is the fact that there's a hormone that does the opposite, corticotropin-inhibiting hormone, and what that seems to do is inhibit activation of glucocorticoids. Nobody's quite isolated what the chemical is, but the best evidence is that it's a chemical that is called delta sleep factor. In other words, it's a hormone that does something else in the brain. It helps onset of sleep. So the very chemical messenger that transitions you into sleep effectively is the same one that decreases glucocorticoid levels. So obviously what we deal with is the flip side, which is if you don't get enough sleep, your glucocorticoid levels are going to go up. Furthermore, particularly so if you don't get enough REM sleep, your glucocorticoid levels are going to go up. So that's a bad thing. That's a bad thing, and deprivation increases the levels of that stuff. And you can show that that messes up cognition in a very typical way. For example, get somebody truly sleep deprived, and the next day their cognition isn't very good. And what does that look like in a brain scanner? What you would expect is give somebody some task and the relevant part of their cortex doesn't activate a whole lot. And what you see, in fact, is exact opposite. In order to pull off the same degree of competence, you have to activate even more of your cortex than usual. What has messed up that ability to focus in your cortical activation? The elevated glucocorticoid levels. So that's not good. Now we have the flip side. We've seen this first piece here, which is sleep deprivation increases glucocorticoid levels. Just to complete this loop, elevated glucocorticoid levels disrupt sleep onset. And that takes all sorts of forms. Glucocorticoids, when they get in and soak your brain, make it harder to transition into slow-wave sleep. Particularly, they're doing something to a brain chemical called serotonin. Stay tuned. Lots of serotonin news coming down the pike in a few lectures. Serotonin, which has something to do with the onset of slow-wave sleep. And by that point, once you have a lot of glucocorticoids, a lot of stress, and you're getting less sleep, you're not doing as much energy restoration in the brain, it's a total mess here. Now, if you think through it, what we've got here is something very disturbing, which is a vicious cycle, a dread vicious cycle going on there of the following sort. So, sleep deprivation raises glucocorticoid levels. Elevated glucocorticoid levels disrupt sleep. And we have a dread vicious cycle, and before you know it, you stay up late one night to watch some late night TV sort of thing, and you're sunk. Because thanks to staying up 15 minutes later than usual, your glucocorticoid levels are higher, and thus the next night you're not going to be able to sleep as well. And it's just terrible, this vicious cycle. Okay, just as one is on the edge of panic there, this vicious cycle is not all that vicious. These two loops do not connect all that much. For one thing being, when you were sleep deprived, yes indeed, glucocorticoid levels go up. Not that much though. And on the other side of the circle, no matter how high your glucocorticoid levels are, if you're exhausted enough, you're eventually going to sleep. In other words, all sorts of the other regulatory factors that have some input as to how much sleep you get, eventually they can override the effects of stress. You break that vicious cycle. Nonetheless, you can have periods of quite dramatic problems with sleep built around periods of stress. And as we've seen, a big consequence of that is your brain isn't restoring energy as efficiently as usual. For example, when glucocorticoids get into the brain, they make it harder for the energy restoration to occur. So we've got this vicious cycle here, which turns out not to be quite as vicious as one might initially panic into, but nonetheless, here's a pattern by which lots of stress will decrease your total amount of sleep. Lots of decreases in sleep elevate glucocorticoid levels, and you've got this pattern there. And the net result is the impact of stress on the total amount of sleep you get. Now we transition to something much more subtle, which is what does stress do not to the quantity of sleep, but to the quality of it? And here you see some particularly disturbing news, because the deal is you can get lots of sleep, but if it's not of the right type, a predominance of the slow wave sleep, you don't get the energy restoration. That's the type of sleep that's really important for that going on, and get a lot of glucocorticoids, get a lot of stress going on there. And not only do you tend to decrease the amount of total sleep, you'll also decrease the percentage of your sleep time devoted to that really helpful slow wave sleep stuff. So you sleep, and thanks to all sorts of problems, you have elevated glucocorticoid levels while you're sleeping. You take all sorts of troubles to bed there, or any sort of plumbing problems there that elevate your glucocorticoid levels. And when you are actually sleeping, there's going to be less slow wave sleep. It's going to be less efficient sleep. It's going to be poorer quality. There's going to be less energy restoration. Now, another feature that stress can do is wreak havoc with more sort of aspects of sleep, and this is where it tells us something very informative about the relationship between stress and sleep quality. And this was some brilliant work done a few years ago by Jan Born at University of Lübeck, and they did the following. Normally, when you're sleeping, you've got this pattern of glucocorticoid release, which we heard about a few lectures ago, which is nice low levels throughout the night's sleep, and somewhere near when you're getting ready to wake up, you begin to have elevated glucocorticoid levels in anticipation of the fact that the most stressful thing every single day in a day without major stressors is that mere process of getting up in the morning and beginning to function. So that's what happens when you have free-running sleep. You sleep until you're ready to wake up. Somehow, your brain senses that it's getting near the end of your sleep period. So send that signal, that CRH, to your pituitary, off you go, and glucocorticoid levels begin to rise. What if your sleep is disrupted, though? And in the first version of the experiment, what they told these volunteers, and they got volunteers who slept such that on the average they woke up around 7 o'clock in the morning, and what they told them was, well, you're going to sleep now, we're going to wake you up at 5 in the morning instead. In other words, we're going to disrupt your sleep at a predictable time in a way that's going to compromise the quality of your sleep. What happens now? Around 4 o'clock in the morning, glucocorticoid levels begin to go up. There's anticipation of the fact that there is going to be disruption of sleep, and the quality of sleep goes down the tubes then. And I experienced this myself like some years ago where I was doing one of these nutty, impossible experiments where I had to take blood from some subjects every 3 hours or so around the clock for days and days and days. In other words, you get the blood sample, you process it for 16 and a half minutes, and then you go and crash until 30 seconds before the next one. And overall, I was getting collectively, I don't know, about 11 hours of sleep each day because I was spending most of the in-between times just sleeping. And I felt lousy. I felt totally exhausted despite having more sleep because the quality of it was disrupted. Because my glucocorticoid levels were cycling up every 2.5 hours or so. So what we see here is it's not only the amount of sleep you get, but how continuous it is, how many pieces it's broken into. Now, one additional detail they did in this study, which really shows sort of the vulnerability of sleep to stress, now what they did was they told these people, okay, you're getting your good night's sleep, and sometime during the night, we are going to wake you up. So a transition from fragmented sleep to unpredictably fragmented sleep. And now what you essentially got were elevated glucocorticoid levels all night long. What's this about? This is the world of medical residents who deal with some crisis at 2 in the morning and finally crash to sleep, and it's not clear to them if they're now going to get to sleep 5 hours or 5 minutes. What's this hierarchy? Total amount of sleep, the extent to which it is continuous, as opposed to fragmented, and if there's fragmentation, is at least at predictable times. So what we've hopefully gotten here is a distressing amount of information convincing us that sleep really is quite an important thing. So with all that distress in hand, now I personally feel like running off to the refrigerator and getting something filled with carbohydrates. Perhaps you want to do the same. Again, punchline here, this is something you want to get enough of, and on the average, we get way too little.
Lecture 16, Stress and Aging.
As you will hopefully recall, the last lecture was about sleep and stress, and I began it confessionally saying it's like my least favorite topic in the whole field of stress because I can't talk about it and think about it without getting all agitated because I'm lousy at getting enough sleep. However, truth be told, this is my least favorite lecture because I appear to also be lousy at getting older. What's the picture of aging? Picture of aging is wonderful when it works right. You become wise, you become peaceful, you become self-actualized, you wind up looking like Jessica Tandy or someone. It's all great. And as far as I can tell, I am not hurtling in that direction at all. I do not anticipate being wise or calm or any of that. Instead, I suspect I'm going to be paying the price of way too much agitated stress throughout the years. And what this lecture is about is trying to look at the actual science underlying that distressing outcome. What does stress have to do with aging? Lots. And to begin to appreciate that, where we have to start off with is, what's aging about? What is the biological process? How could you define aging? And we all know how to define aging in a very technical sort of way. Aging is the time of life where your body goes to hell on you. Okay, we could probably define that a little bit more precisely. Aging is the time of life where you become more fragile. Aging is the time of life where if you take a 20-year-old and an 80-year-old and they both slip on the ice, the 80-year-old is more likely to get the broken pelvis. Aging is the time of life where, as just described, you become more fragile. For the same insult, you are more likely to get injury. For the same degree of challenge, you are more likely to get injured. Fragility, lack of resiliency. So given that, and that's a pretty good technical definition of what aging is about, increased fragility over time, got to give you a first absolutely stunning fact about this whole field, which is, by that definition, an awful lot of species on this planet don't age. Absolutely remarkable. They don't age, they don't show this property of becoming more fragile over time. That's amazing. Now, mind you, these are not some of the most exciting species on Earth. These are amoeba and fungi and liverworts and who knows what. This is not to say that they live forever. If you get hit by a meteor and you're an amoeba, and it doesn't matter really what age you are because it's going to do you in, but nonetheless, you don't see that pattern of increased fragility during time. And a 500-year-old redwood tree is just as likely or just as unlikely to be done in by some beetle infestation as a 50-year-old redwood. A large percentage of the species on this planet do not age by this rule of increased fragility over time. Second amazing feature of this field, when you think about that as the definition of aging, the species that do age are some of the most recently evolved ones. They're some of the fanciest ones out there. They're vertebrates, they're mammals, they're primates. And you suddenly have this boggling realization, aging is a recent invention. Aging is in the evolutionary avant-garde. the genes that are central to this process of becoming more fragile over time, by the standpoint of the glacial pace of evolution, evolved relatively recently in some of the most complex species on this planet. What is this about? This is totally bizarre. And what you begin to see, though, is a hint about what aging, what this increased fragility, might be good for. You look at a pattern of what aging is like, what population dynamics are like, in those species that, in fact, don't age. And you can sort of chart this in a way where you start off with, obviously, 100% of the population, and somewhere out the other end, you're going to have 0% of the population still alive, but the rate at which they disappear is an absolute straight line. For those of you who care about such mathematical minutiae, it's on a logarithmic scale. Nonetheless, over the course of time, the number of individuals in that population declines at the same exact rate. There's no aging. No matter how long an organism has been around, it does not become intrinsically more fragile. So now you look at those recently evolved species that show aging, that show this property of increased fragility. And you can see that in a way that is, in fact, definitional. As you start with 100% of the population, and as time goes by, at some point, it stops being a straight line. At some point, the population declines faster than that straight line would predict. What's that? That's the aging process. That's beginning to fall apart after a certain time of life. That's beginning to be more fragile. So again, this notion, this stuff might have evolved relatively recently. Evolution does not bring about sort of processes that make you fall apart as you get older. There's got to be something adaptive about it. And you look at those population dynamics, and then you see something interesting. Because the species that show aging, in other words, at some point, instead of population number declining in a smooth line, it suddenly crashes a lot faster, you notice something else. Which is earlier in life, the survival rate is better than that straight line would have predicted. And this is really interesting. And what this is, you know, if you want to term it, this is the there's no free lunch hypothesis about aging, which is as follows. What aging is about is not the genetics, the evolutionary adaptiveness of falling apart as you get older. It's about all sorts of advantages earlier in life that increase evolutionary success, increase the number of copies of genes you pass on, and there's no free lunch. Eventually the bill comes, which is now falling apart faster than anticipated. And when framed this way, this is great. When framed this way, this is not the evolution of falling apart. This is the evolution of all sorts of genetic advantages earlier in life, and eventually you pay the bill. And there's even a fancy technical term for this, and do not even dream of memorizing this. This is called negative pleiotropy. The notion of some genetic trait that gives you advantages earlier in life at the cost of disadvantages later on. And that's what aging really is. Okay, this is very abstract. Let me give you one example. In primates, you see this pattern in male primates, in fact, which is you've got prostate glands, and prostate glands do something or other to your sperm, and I don't know what they do. I once knew it for a final exam for about 3 hours, but your prostate makes your sperm happier and faster and jump higher, and primates tend to have prostate glands with very high metabolic rates. In other words, that are really good at making your sperm all perky. So that's the early stage in the curve. That's where the fertility rate, that's where the passing on number of copies of your genes is doing better than expected. And what's the bill that eventually comes? You can't spend your whole life with your prostate having this blasting high metabolic rate without the danger being that metabolism will spiral out of control into uncontrolled growth, into cancer. And thus we have an explanation for why male primates, and particularly human ones, are so vulnerable towards prostatic cancer as they get older. So there's no free lunch theme. Most organisms do not show this classical pattern of aging. Those that do, they're more in the evolutionary avant-garde. And those that do, it's not really selection for falling apart. It's selection for a trait that's advantageous earlier in life, and along comes the bill. So now we have some sense of what the aging process is about. So where does stress intersect with it? And from virtually day one in the 1930s, with Selye popularizing the term, with the whole field taking off as a subfield of medicine, from day one, people were already thinking, okay, stress and aging, they've got to be intertwined in some sort of very basic way. And this theorizing took two forms, and we're going to spend this talk exploring these two. The first one: aging is a time of life when organisms don't deal with stress very well. Second notion, lots of stress throughout the lifetime will accelerate the aging process. And as you can immediately see, we've got yet another vicious circle on our hands. Stress, lots of stress, makes you get older faster. Older, more fragile, can be translated in our language into less of an ability to deal with stress. So what's the evidence for these two ideas? Focusing on the first one, the notion of aging being a time of life where you don't deal very well with stress. There is endless evidence for this at all sorts of different levels of body function. At the cellular level, we know a little bit about DNA from the earlier lectures, and DNA, in fact, every time cells divide, you make a copy of the DNA, and that's great, and with a shockingly high rate, there's mistakes. There's little hiccups of mistakes in copying your DNA into the new cell, little mutations that slip in, not infrequently, lots of the time. And fortunately, we come with some spanking efficient, overactive ADD-ish sort of enzymes in there that repair your DNA. And typically, they keep up just fine, lots of little random mistakes in your DNA, which quickly get fixed up. So, of course, we've got here a grim finding, and one that fits in with this picture of aging being a time of life where you don't deal with stress very well. In this case, the stress of having DNA damage, your capacity of doing DNA repair goes down as you get older. Another example. Now, rather than at the cellular level, at the level of sort of organ, whole organism physiology, take someone and experimentally drop their core body temperature a couple of degrees and then see how long does it take the body to get it together and overcome this hypothermic stressor. How long does it take for core body temperature to get back to where it was? And what you see is the older the individual, the longer it takes. Resting body temperature does not change with age for the most part. The baseline function does not change. What changes is the capacity to recover from a temperature stressor. Aging is a time of life where you don't deal with stress very well. Final example, very much on the whole organism level, what happens to IQ with aging? Notice I am not saying what happens to intelligence with aging and the extent to which IQ tests test intelligence. I'm not going within a mile of that one. But in the much more narrow sense, what does the aging process do to IQ performance? And the answer is, it depends. It depends on all sorts of factors, including how much time pressure there is to the test. And you give somebody some cognitive sort of test, an IQ test perhaps, or other versions thereof of cognitive function, and what you see is the less time pressure there is, the longer somebody can spend on it, the less of an age-related decline there is in performance. Often no decline whatsoever. Now throw in a stressor, not the stressor of DNA mistakes or the stressor of hypothermia, now throw in the stressor of time pressure, less and less time to carry out this task, and the more time pressure there is, the more there's an age-related decline in performance. So what we see here is lots of evidence, cellular level, organ level, whole organism level, for this notion that aging is a time of life where you don't deal with stress very well anymore. So naturally, what we want to do is translate this into one of our greatest markers of stress. What happens to glucocorticoid levels as we get older? What happens to patterns of activation of the sympathetic nervous system? And the general pattern that you see in a bunch of species, lots of rodents, for example, is as you get older, your resting basal levels of glucocorticoids begin to climb. In other words, as you get older, in the absence of stress, your body is acting as if there's a mild stressor. What about humans? The picture is a little bit more complicated in that you look in an older literature and you look at what happens to resting glucocorticoid levels as you become geriatric, and the answer that was in the literature was there's no change, levels stay just fine. And you look at those older studies and you find something that I thought was kind of humorous way back when I was a grad student and horrifying now, which is back in the old days, they would do studies where geriatric populations were defined as, say, age 50 or higher. My God, what things were like back when. So now when you have studies in gerontological ones, aging is thought to really count as blasting along extreme aging, age 80 or so. And when you look at that literature, glucocorticoid levels stay reasonably flat until extreme old age, and then they take off. They tend to rise. Similar pattern as well with the sympathetic nervous system. So you've got one marker of your body not dealing very well with stress in old age, elevated basal levels of glucocorticoids. Now a second problem comes in, and this is one that is screamingly familiar by now conceptually from some of these earlier lectures, which is the stress response, the amount of glucocorticoids you could pump out in response to a stressor. That doesn't change a whole lot during aging. What does change, and this will make perfect sense, is the recovery time, how long it takes to get back to baseline. So the sort of changes you see during aging in this